You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of April, 2016, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
Raphael, straight out of the hills of Canada, 4 years in Canada, was a Canadian citizen until 14, 15 months ago.
Donald Trump isn't a big fan of his Republican rival Ted Cruz, but could an electoral pact between Cruz and John Kasich be about to thwart Trump's presidential ambitions? And
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulder.
And it will not work in 2008 because Barack Obama is on the right side of history.
What's happening with respect to her position on refugees here? She is on the right side of history on this.
Why do the world's leaders of today care about what tomorrow's historians write about them? We'll also discuss why an inability to count left bank robbers in Uzbekistan feeling pretty short-changed. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guest today, Xenia Wickett, who's the head of the US and Americas program and also the dean of the Queen Elizabeth II Academy at Chatham House, and John Everard, who is a former British diplomat. Welcome both to the program. Now, we're going to begin with plotting in the Republican Party, where Donald Trump's rivals for the presidential nomination have ganged up on him. Ted Cruz says he won't campaign in key primaries to help John Kasich. Kasich, in turn, has promised to scratch Mr. Cruz back in the Indiana primary. Well, the pact could make it difficult for Trump to reach the magic number of delegates needed to win the contest outright. And it's angered him, although he says Cruz and Kasich are totally desperate and have no chance of wrestling the party's nomination from him. Well, Xenia, what isn't going on here? Is it just a numbers game that these two gentlemen have finally realised that the only way to stop Mr. Trump is to kind of help each other?
It's absolutely a numbers game. I mean, the American system is such that at this point, you can sit there and say, who do I think has got the better policy, etc., etc. Right now, that's irrelevant. What's relevant is who actually wins the 1,237 delegates, Republican delegates, that you need to win the nominee. If you're below that, it's a contested convention in July. If you're above that, Trump goes into the convention as the nominee. For him, it's incredibly important because, frankly, if he doesn't win the nomination, the probability that he will win the contested convention diminishes quite considerably. So for him, he very much wants it to be uncontested, which it has been every election for the last, since the, I think, 60s, which is the norm. So it is all about numbers. Let me just say one other thing, which is, what's interesting is that belatedly Cruz and Kasich have come together to say, you know what, I'll give you some states to focus on, you can give me some states to focus on so that we can divide responsibility and be more effective in terms of winning delegates so Trump doesn't win them. At the same time, they've also said, yeah, but we're not going to take our name off the ballot. So I'm not going to tell my supporters to not vote for me. I'm just not going to actually go out and, do events and really push hard to get the vote. It's a little unclear to me, frankly, at this point, how much of a difference this is going to make. It will make some, absolutely, but it's not clear that it's going to make enough.
I just wanted to know that. So in your view, it's not clear that it's going to be a success, this kind of trading.
So the issue is, if you look at all the polls and you look at the states that Trump is almost sure, based on the polling, to win, then the only two that are kind of close-ish are California and I think it's Indiana. Indiana is one of the ones because California and Indiana also have a large number of delegates. California is proportional representation, so at some level it doesn't actually matter whether both Cruz and Kasich actually both are out there, and they've not said they're going to step down on California. Indiana, it does matter because that's it's a winner-take-all state. So that one actually is a very important one for Cruz to win. If he doesn't, that's the end of the story. That's the end of the story. Trump gets the nomination.
John, is there a whiff of danger here? Because What's interesting is Trump has done well because he said there's too much business as usual going on between politicians. They're horse trading between each other. They're doing deals without you, members of the public, getting your say. Now, here we have a prime example of two politicians making a deal with, ignoring in a way their voters and the people who have supported them to get this far, it feels like. Is there a chance that Trump might rather do better out of this than you'd imagine?
It is possible. And although it sticks in my craw to say it, to an extent, Trump is right. I mean, this is classic American political maneuvering of just the kind that he's pilloried right through his campaign, as you just pointed out. And I think that message will resonate with his voters. I have to agree with Zinia. I'm not at all sure that this is actually going to make a whole lot of difference one way or the other. It might have made a difference if they had agreed actually to stand down. It would have made a difference if one or other of them, like a month ago, 6 weeks ago, before some of the bigger primaries, had agreed to duck out of the race and have just one anti-Trump candidate. But that hasn't happened. It's not likely to happen in the future. And, we'll see next week. But I suspect that behind all this bluster and rhetoric, Donald Trump must be feeling not too bad about his prospects just now.
If it does force it to go to the wire, and if we do go to a contested convention and there's a punch up on the floor, as it were, is there still potentially a candidate standing in the wings who we haven't seen in the last few months who could come charging onto the stage and snatch victory?
There's essentially three scenarios for the contested convention. The first scenario is that, Donald Trump wins many delegates, but not the 1,237. It goes to a contested convention and he's close enough that he's able to actually bring it off at the contested convention. That's option number one. Option number two is he doesn't do that. After the first round of voting, and the American system is so complex, I'm going to be polite. But after the first round of voting, a lot of the delegates, about 75% of the delegates, are then free to vote for whoever they want rather than who the public told them to vote for. So if Trump doesn't win in the first round, then his ability to win diminishes considerably. Then the second scenario is essentially that it goes between Kasich and Cruz. Cruz would almost certainly win it. That's the likely scenario. The third scenario is that you've got a, white knight, black horse, whatever you want to call it, that comes in from the margins. That could be, we could go back to Jeb Bush or somebody like that. That's probably unlikely. Much more likely that it would be a Paul Ryan, who is now the head of the Republicans in the Senate. But he's very clearly said he's not interested in the job. Now, he said that before and nevertheless taken the senior position in the Senate. So, so one can take that with a certain pinch of salt. But I think it's unlikely. I think it's either effectively you've got Trump or Cruz. Unless something truly outrageous happens, it's Trump or Cruz.
Yeah. God, it's never been a better time to be a mathematician if you're following US politics. I think you're kind of highly in demand.
That's right. And I'll say, not long to follow. After the primaries on Tuesday, we're going to have most of the answer.
Yeah.
You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Zinia Wickett, and also John Everard.
A day like today, it's not a day for sort of sound bites, really. We can leave those at home. But I feel the hand of history upon our shoulder in respect of this. I really do. And I just think we need to acknowledge that and respond to it. Now, maybe it's impossible to find a way through. Maybe even with the best faith in the world, you can't do it. But it's right to try. So I'm here to try.
It didn't work in 1992 because we were on the right side of history. And it will not work in 2008 because Barack Obama is on the right side of history.
What's happening with respect to her position on refugees here in Europe? She is on the right side of history on this.
President Obama there on how the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, will be on the right side of history over her handling of Europe's refugee crisis. We're also just hearing Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, who are equally keen on that phrase, as were some of Russia's most notable Marxist revolutionaries. But why do today's politicians worry about what the historians of tomorrow might write about them? John, first of all, where is the right side of history, do you think?
I think, I can be quite explicit on this, the whole theory is utter bunkum. There is no right side of history. I mean, the idea that history is this kind of motive force, almost animate, comes straight from discredited Marxian ideals. History is just one thing after another, as we all learned when we were very, very young. And the idea that something can be the right side or the wrong side of, sorry, I just don't buy it.
Zenya, do you think there is a right side of history? Because being, you know, on the other, you know, being provocative about this, you know, surely the right side of history seems to be somebody who is on the side of progress. Now, that's a hard thing to kind of, you know, align. But when you look back through history, the people who tried to, say, stop women having the vote, or tried to stop children having to kind of, you know, toil and labour, you know, as 10-year-olds, whatever, those people are now seem to be on the wrong side of history. So is the right side of history felt to be always the progressives?
I think you've just put your finger on it. I think there is a right side of history. I think all politicians, let's face it, all of us, politicians or otherwise, want to be on the right side of history. We want to be seen to be making the right decisions. We want to be remembered for making the right. You know, who wants an epitaph that says, yeah, that, you know, they kind of got it wrong again and again? I mean, nobody wants that. We all want to be on the right side. The trouble is history is written by the winner more often than not. And there isn't a black and white. So the winner then defines what is the right side. I mean, a great case in point, I was listening a few weeks ago to a talk by Laurie Freeman. He's written a big book on strategy. And we were talking about, you know, whether Obama will be seen to be on the right, using different language, right side of history, or whether, you know, Putin. And Putin seems to be winning a lot of the narratives. The right side of history is based on narratives. So even though most of us sitting here will probably say Putin is on the wrong side of history, what he's done in Ukraine is the wrong side of history. It is, you know, invading another country is the wrong thing to do. If he gets to write the history books, whether it's in Ukraine or Syria, a decade from now, 2 decades from now, actually, he may be able to define that as the right side of history, even though we sitting here today would say otherwise. So, I mean, I think it totally depends on who's the author. This is all about the narrative that you can create. Right now, we're not necessarily creating our own narratives quite as well as we might like.
John.
When we say that people are on the wrong side of history, what we mean is we don't like what they're doing.
Exactly.
Why don't we just say that? When historians talk back
and say... It doesn't sound nearly as good.
Yeah, okay. It lacks the soundbite effect, I grant you that. But when historians look back and say that people were on the wrong side of history, what they mean is that they lost their battles. Why can't we say that as well? I'm with Butterfield on this. History is a harlot. History is everything to all men and can be quoted in support of pretty much anything you like. We're saying just now that the right side of history means that you're on the progressive side. The trouble is that nobody can agree what progressive is. Remember that Franco was quite convinced that he was on what you would say is the right side of history. He was supporting truth, the church, eternal Spain against the filthy communists who wanted equal rights for women and other disabilities and things like that. Kim Il-sung's autobiography is translated into English as With the Century. Essentially, he was saying, I was history. I made the historical process work towards the ideals of the Korean Revolution. The result is today's North Korea. Is that progressive? He thinks it's on the right side of history.
But don't you think when you look back, you know, we aren't, you know, North Korean communists. We're kind of Western liberals at heart, really. So when we look at the great arc of history and we look at, say, the Nazis versus...
Arc of history?
Let me know. I can have all sorts of things here. I'm in charge of the show. When you look at that arc of history, surely when you look back, you can't just say everybody's equally good and equally bad and it's, you know, it just tends to be how things work out. When you look back at that arc of history, surely you think, actually, there was a better side and a not such good side. You know, maybe there is a hint of morality that comes into it, but surely in that exchange in history, we think there was the right side to be on.
You can argue that people did the right thing, people did the wrong thing. Absolutely, okay, fine. I'm a wishy-washy Western liberal. We're all in this together. We are, Zenya? Okay, yep, Zenya yep. too. Right, all three of us. Fine,
it's a nice
we agree on morality, but that's quite different from talking about the right side and the wrong side of history.
I would just add, go back to the United States. Carter is generally considered to be a very ineffective American president. Didn't get anything done, you know, Iran revolution over his watch, et cetera, et cetera. He was probably the most moral president that America's had in an awful long time. We critique Bernie Sanders today. Lots of people on the Democratic side just say it's unrealistic. You know, his policies are undoable. You know, you can't actually do that. But I think many people would say, from a moral perspective, should there be more equality in the world? Yes, there should. So is he on the right side of history? Will we eventually get to where Bernie Sanders wants us to be? Possibly. But he's probably not going to win this time.
But
does that make him on the right or the wrong side of history?
For both of you, when you look at, say, Blair or you look at Obama, should we distrust a politician that cares about what their obituary will be or where their place will be in history? Because when you look at, listen to Blair, in many ways, that's what worries you about him. He was worried about his position and what people would think of him after his time in office. Who cares? You should be doing a good job while you're in office.
Okay. We're incensed. Go on, John.
Okay. You have to, if you're a politician, you have to have passionate beliefs. Otherwise, you're just wasting your time. That doesn't mean that everybody believes in those passionate beliefs in the same way that you do. Hitler, too, profoundly believed that he was doing the right thing. And we can guess what he might have wanted on his epitaph.
But Blair was just too concerned, wasn't he, about his kind of, you know, that epitaph.
I actually fundamentally disagree with that. Because our politicians should be looking to the long term. They should be looking 20, 30, 40 years ahead and saying, where do we want the world to be and how do we get ourselves to a better place in that time frame? That is exactly what history is. If we're saying, ignore where you think people are going to judge you 40 years from now, ignore the long term, then we're saying, just do short-term things that are going to benefit you now.
I agree. I like the idea of long-term planning. I wish there was more of it around. History, though, isn't the planning at the beginning. It's when you look back at the end and see where you got to.
But when we look at Obama, and you know, is he a bit too concerned also about history? Every speech he makes has got some historical reference.
His last year. I mean, give him a break. I mean, I think that's...
But is he worried about the library, you know, the Obama library, and what's going to happen after his time? And that's what I think some people get a bit worried about, because he's so quick to quote a historian every moment and judge other people. And in the end, he should be, as you're right, focusing on the economy in his last year in power.
And I think he is. I mean, I think the problem that presidents or prime ministers have is when you're in your last year in power, there's not a hell of a lot you can do. You know, actually, you know, your party isn't behind you because you're yesterday's leader. Most other governments aren't terribly interested in what you have to say because, frankly, you're not going to have power in 10 months or in 6 months, so they're not going to go out of their way. So actually, thinking a little long term, thinking a little historically, a little in terms of a different perspective, doing some strategic thinking, actually, I suspect that's not a bad way to spend your time.
Go on, John, be brave. Is Obama on the right side of history?
But that actually is rubbish. Obama's doing the right thing. That's enough for me.
Senor, is he on the right side of history?
I think history will be written in 2 decades, and then we'll know whether he's on the right side of history.
Well, you heard it here. We're going to take a short break now, but we're going to be back shortly with something about cyber attacks.
Being a pop star seems like a dazzling, lavish lifestyle, right? But have you ever wondered how your favourite pop song was written?
I do a lot of writing in the bath with my housemate sat on the toilet taking a photo.
Or who that song was really intended for.
Writing love songs in Spanish, I could say really pathetic, sad things, and it would be a secret from the audience and also from the person that I was writing about.
Join us on The Sessions at Midori House each week, where we bring in a wealth of musical talent to perform live for us and reveal a few truths about making music and keeping your ego under control. Well, sometimes.
I'm unconsciously comparing myself like a jackass to Paul McCartney.
From electropop to indie rock and with plenty of soul to boot, tune into The Sessions at Midori House every Saturday at 8:15 London time for lessons in stardom and a soundtrack to kickstart your weekend.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The New York Times is reporting that the US is planning to step up cyber attacks against Islamic State militants. US Cyber Command has been charged with carrying out the campaign, which aims to disrupt the terrorist group's ability to recruit and raise money. So, is this a good idea? Well, still with me, of course, are Xenia Wickett and John Everard. John, is it a good idea?
Yes, I mean, clearly using this kind of non-lethal weapon to disrupt ISIS's operations is a good idea. Also, interesting, I mean, there are two stories here. First is the substance of the cyber attacks. The second is why they've decided to announce this right now. And I suspect that what they're trying to do is to rattle ISIS. Of course, ISIS will never know quite how far US capability extends. And if this caused them to draw back from transactions that might otherwise have taken place, to be a little more shy about putting themselves up on social networks, then without lifting a finger, the United States has scored a victory.
So when I was reading the reports, I couldn't quite guess exactly what's going on, but some of it seemed to be hinting they might just be going after their Facebook page. Is that really an effective way to stop them?
Hugely effective. I mean, you know, you think about how effective ISIS has been through social media, through the internet, through kind of electronic communication. That absolutely means that those who would fight ISIS have to use similar means. If that's the Facebook page, if that's Twitter feeds, if that's, you know, all of the other newer social media systems, then absolutely that's a way that the US government and others should attack them. But not only that. I mean, they're talking about transfer of money. How do they actually stop money being transferred? How can they stop ISIS paying their militants? I mean, I think this is a very, very necessary next step in the fight. I think it would be odd for them not to be doing this.
I watch something of the same techniques apply to North Korea. I'd echo all that. Blocking the transfer of money is a particularly devastating technique. If you can force a state, an organization, to move money around in suitcases, you've scored a major blow. I mean, suitcase money is very difficult and very vulnerable.
And it's not just stopping ISIS, but of course, you know, to the question of why tell the world that this is what you're doing? Wouldn't you be better off just keeping it quiet and, you know, catching people as you can? It also potentially will have a huge effect on those who would support ISIS, who suddenly go, it's no longer risk-free. I mean, I might actually be caught before I actually even leave my own country. And so, you know, what is currently, oh, I can send them a little money, nobody will know, will now become, maybe I shouldn't, they may find this one out.
But John, what should we expect from this? Because, you know, I think they're talking about they're describing it as dropping cyber bombs, which is all very well and good. But actually, I think everybody agrees that the only way of winning this war in the end is some feet on the ground, maybe some, you know, cyber attacks here and there, and some more conventional weapons as well. So are they kind of saying, oh, right, we're going to leave that bit to, you know, the Russians and some other people, especially in Syria, and we'll do our nice stuff from, you know, Washington, where we don't have to kind of like put boots on the ground?
Well, yes, I don't think there is a silver bullet that's going to win this war. It's going to be won by a whole lot of smaller components to an overall mix. And I think cyber warfare is part of that. I mean, whether in the end the United States ends up putting boots on the ground, leaves it to Russians, I don't know. But I'm in no doubt that the announcement of cyber attacks is significant.
But if I can pick up on this, Andrew, I actually disagree with you. Boots on the ground isn't the answer. We are not going to win this war until we actually start fighting the ideology. We change the way people think. This is not something that can be won through military mechanisms, if you will. That means cyber warfare, absolutely. That means boots on the ground, absolutely. It has to be a combination. But it also means fighting the ideology. Fighting the ideology is something you also do through the internet, through cyber. And so I think that one has to see what the US is doing, what the US DOD is doing in terms of Defense Department, is doing in terms of cyber warfare, yes. But you also have to look at what an awful lot of other people are doing in terms of actually fighting the ideology, fighting the thought process, actually trying to get less people to support ISIS in the first place.
So it's almost like having your own partisans on the ground with this cyber campaign. But interestingly, do you think there's a risk, Daniel? Because, you know, they've been working against Iran, they've been working against North Korea, as John said. There can't be that many people in the end to kind of spread across all of these potential targets. So I presume that it means that some of those other places are now going to get a bit of a kind of a softer time.
Well, what's interesting is the Defense Department has always been very quiet about its cyber offensive capabilities. So it's never actually confessed to the attacks against Iran, Flash and Stuxnet, even though I think most people accept the fact that the Americans were involved along with the Israelis, because there's a real fear of kind of the crossing that sovereignty line. There isn't that problem when you go after terrorists of crossing a sovereignty line. But I think you're going to find that the USG is very sensitive towards revealing what it is capable of doing in a cyber offensive way. Cyber defense is a far easier thing to confess to, if you will.
John, there was some violent shaking of the head there when I suggested that North Korea might get an easier time.
Yes, there's a misapprehension here that this doesn't necessarily mean stretch in the resources that the United States allocates to this. The number of people that you need to conduct cyber warfare is proportional not to the agents involved, but to the number of channels. That is to say that if you know that there are serious transactions going on between banks, you simply tell your agents in future to intercept not only the one, to take your example, associated with North Korea, but also the ones associated with ISIS. You simply put more numbers into your database to flick up. It doesn't necessarily mean more bods.
Well, we're going to move on to our final story, indeed. And it comes from Uzbekistan, where bank robbers have been left counting the cost of not knowing the value of their own currency. The criminal gang seem to have pulled off the perfect heist when they stole 45 sacks of banknotes worth 16 million Uzbek soms. There was only one problem. There are 4,000 Uzbek soms to the British pound, for example. So the robbers have been left pretty short-changed. John, I think you spotted this story earlier today. Now, it shows us something, of course, about the problems with many of these nations, these former Soviet nations, especially in the region of the Stans. And, you know, Uzbekistan has been very dependent on gas. It seems to be in a bit of a perilous state at the moment. Is that why you think this bank story is most fascinating? Because it does reveal to us, doesn't it, there's something pretty wrong with a banking system like that.
Well, yes, it says there's something very wrong with the Uzbek banking system. It does says there's something very wrong with a country that cannot produce a higher denomination note than one worth 80 cents on the black market. But I love this story, not because of the politics or the economics, because of the human angle, just the vision of these two hapless bank robbers sort of carefully getting the bank, loading 45 sacks full of these banknotes, taking them all home, doubtless thinking they're going rich as Croesus, and then suddenly, horribly, the truth dawns on them that they've got an amount of money which, if you carried it around in the form of $100 bills, you could easily just stick in your back pocket. What a letdown.
Zenia, it is kind of fascinating. Apparently, one of the stories that came out today was that this is why bank robberies are so rare in Uzbekistan, because nobody can think
it.
How they're going to carry all the cash away. What? But when we look at these former states, there is a kind of a real problem going on, don't you think, with all of these stars? They all seem a bit wobbly at the moment.
I think they all are. I mean, back to being on the right side of history or not, you know.
I knew there was a right side of history. I said it earlier. Thank you.
You know, there's a real question. You know, if you want to ask a question, you know, for all of the faults of the democratic system, is it nevertheless probably the strongest system we have available to us? I think the answer is clearly yes.
And John, weren't you were a former ambassador to Belarus. You
yes.
know what it's like to be in these former Soviet states. Is part of the problem they just have, you know, they've had some good times sometimes from natural resources and, you know, some money pouring in from gas or from oil or from iron ore. But in the end, many of these former states have still failed to modernize their economies.
Yes, I think there's a lot of that. I mean, there are structural problems. There are resource problems in many of the states. But structural problems are paramount. And Uzbekistan is in deep dudgeon with the international institutions because it hasn't reformed. It's still running massive deficits. It hasn't liberalized its current account and so on and so forth. Were these guys on the wrong side of history? I don't know about that. They were quite definitely on the wrong side of bank robbing.
Yes.
Zenia, what do you think this says about also the police? Because apparently the guy, one of the people who was involved, was one of the policemen there. So again, it kind of hints that, you know, this is a state that's known for being rather brutal and tough sometimes. But it feels that there's some cracks and fissures that people feel it's even now worth taking a chance. You might get away with this.
But I think that's true everywhere. I mean, the question that I would ask, I mean, one of the interesting pieces in this particular article is a local businessman said, you know, this is crazy. If you want to, you know, I have that amount of money in my pocket, you know, probably not in Uzbek soms, but in, you know, US dollars or British pounds. And you kind of have to ask yourself, well, they should have been a little smarter. You know, if you've got some local businessman walking down the street with that, wouldn't that be a more effective way to actually steal money?
Well, I think the lesson from this is do your soms before you do a bank robbery in Uzbekistan. I think that's rather good, actually. Anyway, after the battles of earlier on, it's a nice note to end on. I am going to thank my guests today, who are Zenya Wicket and John Everard. Thank you very much for joining us on a really exciting Midori House, I think. Well, that's all we have time for today. The show was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Maria Granina. And our studio manager, well, it was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next, then 1900 Hours, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. And we'll have more music and more stories later on the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 Hours London time. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, of course, and that's 1800 Hours London time. But from now, from me, Andrew Tuck, and my guests, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.